This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Egyptian terror and credit card companies raise minimum monthly payments. Joining us in our New York bureau, Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Mary Mitchell, columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times, is in our Chicago bureau, and George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, joins us this day from Maryland. All right, folks, first off, we want to talk about yet another bombing, this one in Egypt. And before we get into the details, George Curry, I found it interesting to look at the coverage this morning and in comparison, juxtaposing it to the kind of coverage that we saw from the London bombings 2 weeks ago and, of course, last week. I thought it was interesting and really, quite frankly, speaks to some of the issue that those who are raining this terror down on America and other parts of the world who feel themselves, quote, second-class citizens.
Certainly, if you're talking about the coverage, it's certainly the second-class citizen. Anytime you have 64 people, most of them Egyptian, killed in one bombing, that's quite a hit. And also, this is some of the prettiest country in the world. I went there about a year and a half ago, not exactly this area, but not far from it. And that is some of the prettiest area of the Red Sea. So, yeah, you get a much different coverage. Any country other than London, I mean, if you go to where am I losing myself? If you're talking about London versus, yes, that's where we are on this part of the world, London versus Egypt, there's a different coverage because I think a lot of the journalists feel a stronger connection to London, period, and they're going to be heavily biased in that direction, despite the facts.
Walter Fields, what does this say? I mean, we hear this often, the Euro slant, if you will, that's given to coverage, particularly from the United States, the idea that, quite frankly, more people died in this bombing so far than did 2 weeks ago in London. And again, we saw wall-to-wall coverage when it was going on in London, yet here we saw, while it led the news, we only saw it take a small portion of the newscasts of the major outlets here in the United States.
Well, I think it's part and parcel while we're in this mess from the beginning. I mean, the problem we have now is that we're trying to treat a symptom and not the root cause. The problem is that the U.S. has proffered a worldview that is at odds with most of the Arab world. And I think what you're seeing now is the failure of the Bush administration's foreign policy. They have unleashed a Pandora's box on the world by going into Iraq. Many people in the Arab world believe that our policy is directly aligned with Israel, that the only reason why we're in Iraq is to protect the state of Israel, and that you're beginning to see what I think is a long-term problem for the United States in that we are at odds with the world now, and the rest of the world is looking at us through crossed eyes.
Mary Mitchell?
What's interesting here is you look at this story, what happened in Egypt and the attack in Egypt, and you look at what happened in the subways of London. It sort of brings to mind what happens in news coverage in the U.S. If something happens in a predominantly middle-class or upper middle-class white community, you get a headline story because that's unusual. That's not supposed to happen there. If it happens on the south side or the west side, then you get one little paragraph. And that same kind of mindset, and I think this is a media problem, quite frankly, it shows that we have, those of us who work in mainstream press, we still have not reached the levels where we can direct news coverage to the degree that we can confront a problem like this.
Does this speak to
the earlier comment?
Go ahead.
And that is that I don't know if most of the world think that we went to Iraq solely to protect, mostly to protect Israel. I mean, the sentiment I keep hearing over is about the oil. While most of the world is at odds with our view of the Middle East and our tilt toward Israel, I'm not so sure that they see that as the major factor to going to war in Iraq.
I don't think it's the major factor, but I don't think you can deny that when you look at the reaction in the Arab world to the United States' presence in the Middle East, I think many people believe that we are there simply because of our alignment with Israel. That may not be the primary reason, but I think it really does go into people's thinkings in terms of how they view the United States. In terms of the media perspective, one interesting thing about these incidents is that perhaps if you look at the BBC coverage, which ironically from the very beginning of the Iraq war has been leaps ahead of any coverage in the United States. So that also says something, that a state-run media can provide a more broad perspective than private media in the United States. So I think we have to really take a look at what's going on, because it's not as clear as it seems by just looking at media coverage.
Let me ask this, whether or not this, and one does not want to ring a false alarm bell, but if you see historically when you've seen patterns that led to attacks on either America itself or America-owned property on foreign lands, embassies, ships at sea, etc., one can see a pattern that we are starting to see. Do we need to brace ourselves and become ever more vigilant with what we are seeing in the course of the last 2 weeks?
I would say, and this is Mary Mitchell, I would say that is absolutely true. You know, when I'm around my house and my property, I look at these hornet's nests, and I know that if I begin to spray them, if I take a stick and, you know, start hitting it, I'm going to stir it up. And that's exactly what's happened with the war on Iraq. I mean, we have stirred up, the U.S. has stirred up a hornet's nest. And we can expect to see these kinds of bombings and these kind of attacks in other areas of the world.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think our nation has probably the most porous borders of any superpower. The fact of the matter is that much of the U.S. coastline, you cannot prevent people from crossing the border. If you go up to the Pacific Northwest and you see one, you know, state trooper in the state of Washington covering a 500-mile stretch of border, you realize how vulnerable we are. And I think the American public needs to understand that the hell that we have witnessed around the world is now going to be unleashed upon our own doorstep.
Yet, George Curry, last week we argued the point of whether or not we have, for all of what the United States wants to be in terms of safe, we still cling to the idea that we are a free people. And we saw and talked about last week the concern that many are raising with the, quote, random checks of baggage here in the subways of New York and the like.
Yeah, we're free, but we're not free from terrorism. Nor are we free from our politics. And this whole, the real question is, and I don't think, it's not just the Bush administration, it's been the Democrats and Republicans, is our views and our action on the Middle East. And until we change that, or unless we change that, we're going to still face this kind of animosity that we face throughout the world. There's no getting around it. That is where most of this comes from, and it's an issue that doesn't seem to be, that's about to be revisited by the United States.
Talking about changing times, and this is almost shocking for someone who grew up in Detroit, as I did, and certainly knew and know the power of the labor unions. We're finding out now that the AFL-CIO will be possibly boycotted by a number of unions that fall under their umbrella. Walter Fields, when you hear this kind of language and see the changing face of labor and union in this country, what's your thought?
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, this has been festering now for a number of years. When you look at the decline in labor participation in the American economy, only about 8% of privatized jobs are union jobs today. I think labor has created some of its own problems when you look at its own internal policies that has excluded large numbers of people from the ranks of union membership, particularly in the construction trades with African Americans and Latinos. Also, the transformation of the American economy, I don't think labor has kept pace in terms of trying to create a unionized presence in new technology industries. So I think this doesn't come as a surprise. And I think what you're going to see, if there is not a hard break today, I think in short time, you are going to see a hard break from the AFL-CIO by these dissident unions, because I think that they are saying to John Sweeney, all the tinkering you're doing is not enough to bring labor back into prominence in the American workforce.
Sweeney being the head of the AFL-CIO.
Yes.
Mary Mitchell.
Right. You know, I often hear from people who are complaining about some type of job unfairness or some situation. I always ask them the first question is, what about the union? And the answer is always, the union didn't do anything to help me. So I think there are a lot of people, rank and file people, who are just very disillusioned with the union leadership. also you have all these scandals, mob ties, you know, malfeasance when it comes to the money that's been collected from union workers. People are beginning to question whether or not the union has their best interests at heart. And so I think you will see a split of these four groups.
Hey, George, Walter says it doesn't come as a surprise, but I meant in the sense of obviously we've seen this over the course of the last decade, 15 years in particular. But as I said, when I was growing up some 20, 30 years ago, it would have been hard to be it would be hard to believe that, in fact, unions like the FL-CIO or the auto industry's labor unions would see the day that people were actually walking away from them and not wanting to live under the might of their muscle.
No question about it. And that's because that when you compare workers who work for unionized shops and those who don't, they make more money. And that has been the attraction. But as Walter pointed out a while ago, unions represent about 12% of the workers, 8% in the private sector. 50 years ago, they represented a third of the workforce. So part of this frustration is simply it is their loss of a lack of influence, as much influence they had before. And you have the internal problem in terms of people question which way the leadership should go and whether it's been responsive to the other units. And so you have about a third of the union members organization now ready to walk out. So, yeah, this was unthinkable just a couple of decades ago.
Let's turn our attention to something that's really interesting, and that is, in fact, that many of the nation's largest banks are now raising the minimum monthly payment due on the credit cards, and that's from 2% of your balance up to 4%, and that is not, I underline, not including interest. The most interesting part of this story to me is this is happening under mounting pressure from the government, who's asking these banks to raise the minimum monthly payment to help Americans get out of debt more quickly. That's what they're suggesting. But it is also, obviously, to make sure that this money does not set, as Mr. Greenspan often does, forecasting down the way. While it's nice to see that money revolve in terms of day-to-day spending, George Curry, you know, the baker comes to collect eventually.
Yeah, and you're talking about, you know, several major banks and the rest of the industry expected to follow. The good part of this is it'll take less time to pay off the balance here. I mean,
if you have the money,
yeah, if you can do it, and I wasn't sure of all the details, like what happens when you don't pay it. I mean, if you can't just make you pay it, they try to raise the minimum balance. I guess you'll end up still paying more interest because if you don't pay the money. So I'm not sure it really solves anything.
Well, this is a continuation of the rich getting rich and the poor getting poor, because the people who control the money in this country know that, you know, whenever you carry debt and you don't pay it off, you're going to be poor. So what I would suggest is that people run out and get a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, written by Robert Kiyosaki, and get some financial literacy so that they can play the game a lot better than we have been playing it. I mean, right now, the banks are going to win. If you go into default, you end up into bankruptcy. Your credit is ruined. So I just think this is going to be bad overall for the average working person.
Yet that being said, Walter Fields, it seems to me, and Mary mentions it there, the idea of blaming the banks for much of this, a lot of this has to go to the consumer. When in America we live above our means, all of us, no matter what income level you are.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think that's the real problem. Consumer debt in this country is out of control. And over the long term, I think this is a good thing. Over the short term, there are going to be some difficulties for people meeting those monthly payments. But the real problem is when you carry that debt over time with interest on top of it, you are truly enslaved by debt. And I think, you know, as American public, that is a consuming public, and particularly black consumers. You know, we need to understand the all of the circumstances that revolve around our purchasing decisions, and that we need to make better purchasing decisions, because those purchasing decisions don't begin and end on the day you bring something home. They stick with you for years if you're not careful.
But at the same time, I think that because this is government pressure, the banks are doing this under government pressure, we should also be requesting as consumers that something be done about the overly aggressive marketing. I mean, you cannot go to your mailbox without pulling out an offer for a credit card, you know, and yet a lot of us turn them down. But a lot of people, you know, end up getting these credit cards and getting too much debt. There's something that has to be done about the high interest rate. They, you know, some of these bank cards might as well be payday loan people as high as their interest rates. So
well,
I think that the... Right, I mean, I think there's some pressure should be put on the banks too. If we're gonna all play this game, if we're gonna be held have to come up with more money for minimum payment, they're gonna have to stop making it so easy to throwing credit out there.
Well, I agree, but this is where the conservative part of me comes out. No one forces you to get that credit card. And I think part of it is public education, even more so than tinkering with the interest rates. Because when that envelope comes to your house, you've got a choice. You either open it up, sign it, or you throw it in a trash can.
Wait a minute. This is where my liberal side comes out. I agree with that. But here's the problem. You sign a contract. You sign on a line and say, this is what I'm able to pay. This is the minimum payment. That's what you agree to. And all of a sudden, the government comes in and the banks are able to charge you double that.
But that's
the decision before George Curry,
that.
Break the tie here, George Curry. Where do you fall on this?
Well, I actually think that Mary is right in a sense that you can't say you're really concerned about lowering consumer debt and every week you're getting an application for a credit card. There's not a week go by that I don't get some kind of application for. I think that Walter is not wrong either, so I'm going to give both a little kudos. But basically, it is our responsibility in the end. It is our responsibility, but they also have responsibility. If you're serious about this, don't keep sending the cards that try to entice people.
Wow. Way to sit on the fence, George.
Yeah, I'm just learning that, Ed. That's a new trait for me.
Walter, let me ask you real quick here with about 30 seconds, though. It really is, and we should not skip over this in jest, but really is important for African Americans in particular, but poor people in general, to understand the workings of the game and become educated, is it not?
Oh, we absolutely have to, and I think the public has been suckered into believing that it can play a higher financial game than you really can, and a lot of that also includes playing the stock market, the fact that you now have financial news channels which are enticing people to get into, you know, an environment, economic environment, that really wasn't created for them. So now we have the average person believing that they can play, you know, the market the way the pros play the market on Wall Street. It's a very dangerous game.
All right. Walter Fields, Mary Mitchell, George Curry, I thank you all for joining us. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
Coming up, a shrinking map for Greyhound and a conversation with the talented Vivian Greene.